had a backup, so he turned and ran through the shattered glass door. This room was empty, thankfully, so in seconds Dom was in the hall, and in seconds more he was in the stairwell. He raced down 30 floors in 5 minutes, adrenaline propelling him most of the way. By the time he made it to the ground floor, Ryan and Clark were out front, waiting for the valet to retrieve the Mercedes. Dom walked up next to them without a word, and when the car came, he helped Jack get his luggage in the back. They were back on Las Vegas Boulevard before the first responders pulled up out front, with reports of shots fired high in the massive tower. While Ryan uploaded the files taken from Elise's mobile phone, the rest of the team broke down the safe house. Dom called the Dara Sherman and delivered news that she was more than accustomed to hearing these days. It was time to do another mad scramble to get the hell out of town. The Gulfstream took off from Henderson Executive Airport, south of the city, at 1:30 in the morning. Adara spent much of the first hour of the flight tending to Dominic Caruso. He had quite a few cuts and bruises, but no broken bones. Ryan thought his wounds looked pretty superficial, but Adara was the team medic, and for some reason she felt the need to devote a lot of attention to Dom's injuries. While Dom got treatment in the back of the cabin, the rest of the group sat up front and discussed the events of the evening. It was abundantly clear there was a unit of North Korean operatives sanctioned to kill, shadowing employees of Sharp's global intelligence partners. It was unknown if the Sharp's people were coordinating with them or not. It was also decided there wasn't a lot for the operators of the campus to do other than return to Alexandria and wait for Gavin Beery to unlock whatever secrets Elise's phone held. Ryan had been compromised in all this, because an operative of Sharp's clearly knew, or else highly suspected, that he'd coerced her away from her hotel room at the exact moment someone was breaking into it. The original plan would have had no comebacks on Ryan, because Elise would have never known her phone had been compromised. This wasn't good at all from a PERSEC perspective, but there wasn't much any of them could do about this now. Soon after their debrief, the men lowered the backs on their cabin chairs and began nodding off. It was 5:30 in the morning D.C. time and 2:30 a.m. on the body clocks of the worn-out men in the Gulfstream when the light on the cabin phone began flashing. Adara Sherman had been sitting on the couch next to the bandaged and sound asleep Dominic Caruso. She reached over and picked up the mobile handset. Softly, she said, "Aircraft." "Good morning, Miss Sherman. Gavin Beery calling." "Hey, Mr. Beery. All the guys are resting at the moment." "Ah, I bet they're just adorable. Let the others sleep, but throw some water on Ryan and hand him the phone." "Right away, sir." Adara declined the suggestion to use water, so Ryan woke to find her gently nudging him. When he opened his eyes fully and sat up, she handed him the phone. Ryan looked at her. "Beery?" Adara nodded with a smile. Ryan was angry for 2 seconds, then his face illuminated with excitement, and he brought the phone to his ear. "You can't possibly have anything for us yet, can you? You forget how good I am, Ryan. Dom sent me the files he pulled from Elise Legrand's device. They were 256 encrypted, but with an off-the-shelf commercial security software we'd figured out a few months back. It's really not that hard when you take..." "Gavin, that's great. But what did you find in the files?"
"Well, the device was a working Samsung Galaxy phone, so I found some games and stuff. A few ringtones, too."
Ryan was annoyed, but he was glad to hear the man had a little of his swagger back after his disastrous experience in the field in Prague. Gavin waited for a reply, and when none came, he asked, "Not funny?" "What else, Gavin?"
"Oh, yeah, right. There is an application, apparently proprietary in nature. Clearly something that she downloaded from the New Corp application server."
"What does it do?"
"The program is designed to do one thing and one thing only. It is set up to manage and operate a large series of froth flotation cells in sequence. I don't really know what those are, but that's not my department. Ryan had spent the past several days at the facility. He knew exactly what froth flotation cells were. That's the high-tech washing machines that the ore is put into. They separate the minerals from the rest of the powder. If you're saying this program is to run a bunch of them at one time, then it's basically the center of the entire refinery process. Bingo, Jack. Apparently the North Koreans have got themselves a processing plant, but they don't have a brain for it. They sent this sexy French mademoiselle to the American processing plant and made a copy of their entire operations system. Ryan said, as soon as we get back, we've got to get this intel to Mary Pat. She knows the big picture in all this much better than we do. Hopefully this will help her figure out what the hell to do next. Chapter 48. The morning after his arrival in North Korea, CIA officer Adam Yao and his fellow Chinese mining technicians ate a breakfast of noodles and tea in the dining room of the Yonggakdo International Hotel, and then they were led into a banquet room on the second floor of the massive building. After they had taken their seats, one of their minders stepped up on a riser and took his place behind a lectern. His Mandarin-speaking translator followed him up, and she picked up a microphone. Through the translator, the minder let everyone know they would be going back to the airport that afternoon for the hour-long flight north to Chongju, but for this morning, they would enjoy a lecture that would help them get acquainted with North Korea, its customs, its citizenry, and its rules. Adam groaned inwardly. The minder then ran down a list of do's and don'ts that everyone must abide by while here in Korea. Some of them seemed just a little picky. No spitting on the ground, for example. But others delved into the bizarre. They were told they were not allowed to fold, crumple, or discard any picture of the Daewonsu. This included newspapers, magazines, and other media, all of which had photos of the Supreme Leader on virtually every page. Adam wondered how newspapers were discarded, but he knew enough not to raise his hand and draw attention to himself. It was explained that radios were outlawed unless they had been converted to pick up only certain stations, all of which were controlled by the central government. There were only a few television stations. They broadcast only at certain times, and even their scheduled broadcasts were subject to interruption. Adam wasn't in town to watch TV, but some of the others mumbled quietly in annoyance. After the minder stepped down, a woman took the stage and began what turned out to be a 50-minute speech about the Daewonsu, his father, and their special relationship with China. The North Korean leadership was spoken of in reverential terms, and the woman's eyes misted over more than once as she talked of the Choi family, claiming it was only through their action that Big Brother China had been saved from wars and famine. She said North Korea had invented several technologies crucial in mining, computer technology, and even air travel, all of which the people in the audience benefited from greatly. It was complete and utter lunacy, and the small crowd, mostly pulled from China's well-educated high-tech sector, sat angry and dismayed. This was the first time Adam had seen up close and in person this level of brainwashing, and it was chilling. These people lived in a closed society. They had no access to the internet, satellite TV, or even most radio. Still, Adam's colleagues knew who was paying their wages, and they also knew who held the guns out in the hallway. While any one of these Chinese technical advisors could have stood up and announced that everything the woman said was wrong, no one did so. When the lecture on the intellectual, cultural, and historical supremacy of North Korea was over, several armed men entered the banquet room from a door on the right, followed by an entourage of older men in business suits. In the middle of the group, a small man emerged, flanked on both sides by uniformed guards. Adam craned his neck to see the top of a bald head. Soon the bald man stepped onto the little stage and up to a microphone. He spoke in Korean, which the translator converted, but his voice was even and easy to hear, so Adam understood the gist of his words even before they were relayed in Chinese. "Good morning, and welcome to the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. My name is Hwang Min-ho, and I am the director of Korea Natural Resources Trading Corporation. It was I who invited you here, so I am very glad to see you all." Adam thought the man sounded somewhat meek and pleasant, especially in comparison to the harsh voices from most of the guards and minders he'd been in contact with since his arrival. Hwang spoke for a while about the mine, the history of North Korea's partnership with China on other projects, and his respect for both the nation of China and its abilities in the mining sector. His words seemed more literal, less jingoistic than those of the woman who had spoken before him, and Adam could easily read the crowd and discern their sense of relaxation. Hwang then offered a surprisingly frank assessment of the conditions at Cheongju. "You will find this facility to be more rudimentary than what you are accustomed to. We ask your patience while we build a processing facility that is state-of-the-art. It will take time. For now, however, we will start slowly and grow to greatness." Yao was surprised that Hwang did not show the same near-psychotic level of reverence for his own nation's capability. Even the fact that Hwang was here addressing the Chinese workers in the first place was fascinating to the CIA non-official cover officer. He hadn't expected to see this man in person at all. Hwang said, "You are guest workers, but you are to be treated well. Your contract says you will work for 8 weeks. Then you will be allowed 1 week for vacation, or, if you prefer, you can continue to work." A man near the front raised his hand and asked, "What is there to do around the mine on vacation?" The director at the lectern shrugged. "Work." There was laughter throughout the room. When he was finished with his presentation, Hwang Min-ho thanked everyone again and then asked, "Are there any questions?" Adam hoped that the rest of his group would be smart enough to keep their mouths shut, but several hands shot up at once. A middle-aged man who Adam had been told worked with the electromagnetic milling machines was called on by Hwang. He asked, "Director, sir, can you tell us about the electrical grid we will find at the facility?" Hwang smiled a little. "We have electricity from a hydroelectric dam nearby. For times when the dam is not generating power, which is often, but not too often, we have oil generators from your country that can keep critical functions up and running. It is not Shanghai, all lights and electric trains, but electricity at Cheongju is a priority during the workday." He smiled again. "At night, you must all sleep so you can work the next day. You don't need light to sleep." Adam already knew the facility and even the entire city of Cheongju were lights out for about 12 hours a day because the electricity didn't run. He'd seen the sat images. Another person asked the one question Adam most wanted to know the answer to. "I understand the facility is still under construction. May we know when you expect to be operational?" Hwang replied, "Construction of the property is complete. We just received a shipment of computers that arrived last week. You all will be responsible for getting them installed and running at your various workstations. Also, there is a new shipment of industrial powder processing equipment and some milling equipment at the refinery that needs to be installed and tested. Other than that, there is one shipment of large equipment still on the way. It should be here very soon. My fervent hope is we will be producing refined metals within 1 month. After saying he would be spending a lot of time at the processing facility in the next few weeks to oversee the opening, Huang left the riser to polite but genuine applause from the Chinese nationals. The bus delivered the technicians to the airport and drove them directly onto the tarmac and up to their aircraft. Adam climbed out of the bus into a blustery wind that foretold a thunderstorm. He looked into the early evening sky and saw thick, dark clouds just west of the capital. Adam found this ominous, even more so when he turned around and looked at the airplane they'd be flying to Chengdu. It was a Boeing 737, wearing the red, white, and blue markings of Air Koryo. Adam had read somewhere that Skytrax, the World Airline Rating Service, had reviewed and rated nearly 700 airlines over the globe, and they had given out but a single one-star rating. Air Koryo, North Korea's national airline, was the recipient. Adam didn't remember where he had read this fact, but as he climbed aboard the plane, he wished he had forgotten it. The Air Koryo flight was bad, but Adam had been on worse flights in the USA. It landed without incident at Kwaksan Airport in an evening rain shower, and the men and women were led onto another bus and then were driven on surprisingly good roads to the city of Chengdu. On this bus ride, as on the other, several armed guards sat at the front, and an olive-drab truck full of troops followed close behind. Adam wondered if the North Koreans were fearful a Chinese technician would leap from the moving vehicle and run out into the hills around the road. It occurred to him that if these people really believed North Korea was the paradise the woman at the welcome meeting this morning had claimed it was, then it stood to reason they'd need to watch out for foreigners trying to break in to reap the nation's bounty. The city of Chengdu was all but blacked out, obviously because there was no electricity running this evening. Beyond the lights of the bus, he could see only the illumination of a few other vehicles on side streets, plus cooking fires, the odd flashlight, and the glow of cigarettes from people on the sidewalks in the darkness. There was one major exception to the darkness. The bus entered a large driving circle, and in the middle was a 40-foot-high statue of Choi Ji-hoon in his military uniform, holding a pair of binoculars in one hand and pointing northward toward China with the other. The entire statue was bathed in bright yellow light, and a tiny street market had been set up around it to take advantage of the glow of the day Wansu. The bus made a turn, and Adam leaned into the window glass and felt a sudden lump in his throat as he saw the entrance to the temporary housing facility. He'd spent a great deal of time in the past week studying this very place in satellite images. To be rolling through the front gates of the complex, it looked like some sort of prison camp from a World War II film, made him feel so much farther from home. Orders were given in Korean and then translated into Chinese by a minder, and soon Adam was lined up in front of the bus with the rest of his group. During a short wait in the darkness, Adam had a moment to recognize that the last time he'd looked at this parking lot in the center of all the metal trailers, he'd been sitting in a tidy and efficient conference room in the Audney building in McLean, Virginia, with a Starbucks latte in one hand and a cinnamon roll in the other. Now he was here, queuing up single file to be counted and checked in, and given a cot. Even for an NOC who'd played a lot of roles in his career, this felt surreal and otherworldly. Chapter 49. 3 days before the arrival of the President of the United States in Mexico City, Iranian bombmaker Adil Zarif was driven back to the parking garage construction site on the corner of Vidal Alcocer and José J. Herrera. It was 7 p.m. and the evening rains had ended, dusk was falling quickly on the area, and the street market had closed. But the area was not quiet. The sounds and lights of construction were obvious as soon as he climbed out of Emilio's truck. Zarif had been told a group of 6 Maldonado men with experience in construction had been working at the site all afternoon. They had a cement mixer and some portable lights, and would be kept away from him while he was here, but they would be all his when he needed them. He'd already spent the entire day building his weapon at an auto repair yard a quarter mile away in northern Tepito. He'd taken his 305-millimeter high-explosive artillery shells, removed the fuses in the nose cones, replaced each with a homemade delayed-action base fuse, wired them to detonate, and attached a blasting cap to each device. The blasting caps were, in turn, attached to a signaling device. At the beginning of the Iraq War, Zarif and men like him used simple electronic detonating signalers, such as garage door openers, to command detonate IEDs. Soon enough, however, coalition forces began taking measures to jam these signals, so Zarif and the others graduated to cell phones. These worked for a while. In fact, Zarif still used these almost exclusively against insurgents in Syria, but cell phones were not a perfect solution either. Their signals could be jammed or otherwise interrupted, and large parts of the world were without coverage. But there was another way. Long-range cordless phones aren't popular in the United States, but in locations with spotty cell coverage, the devices are ubiquitous. The Taiwanese firm Streamtel sold a popular model of phone that consisted of a base station that plugged into a wired phone network and a handset with a range of up to dozens of kilometers. 2 or more handsets could be paired to the same line, and this created a nearly unjammable long-range signaling device. Streamtel sets were components of thousands of IEDs in the Middle East. The company boasted that 40% of its world market share came from sales to Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, and the U.S. military understood the reason behind the demand. Zarif had a Maldonado lieutenant purchase a base station and 2 handsets from a telephone store in Guadalajara and ferry them into the capital city, and the Iranian built his device much as he would have done had he been in Mosul, Iraq, or Helmand province in Afghanistan. It wasn't state-of-the-art, but the veteran bomb-maker always believed the tried-and-true methods were the most reliable. The entire IED was carried into the construction site just after dark inside a large rolling tool chest the size of a steamer trunk, and then Zarif was left alone behind the orange tarp while the half-dozen other men poured concrete on the sidewalk on Jose J. Herrera and in the already built stairwell in the center of the site. The open rebar wall frame that Zarif had found 3 days earlier had changed. The men today had built a lumber casing around the lower 6 feet of the wall, and they had already filled it with concrete. Above this, they had built another wooden frame to raise the wall up to its intended height of 12 feet, but a portion of the frame high on the wall was missing, following Zarif's instructions. One by one, Zarif took the pieces of his IED up a ladder and onto a scaffolding 5 feet off the ground next to the wall, and he gently reassembled the device in the metal rebar grid exposed by the missing boards. The shells faced out toward the 6-lane street on the other side of the tarp. They were positioned 10 feet off the ground, and each one was slightly angled with wooden shunts so that they would project downward onto the street. The artillery shells did not have full charges behind them, nor were they being propelled through long barrels that would spin them through rifling, so they would not launch like they would if fired from a howitzer. Still, Zarif had a design plan for his weapon to ensure that the explosives launched out to the street before detonating. He had 2 Maldonado men help him place 3 90-pound sheets of iron at the back of the device, behind the shells in the grid, using more wooden slats to hold them in position while he soldered them to the rebar. When he finished this, he had created a plate to deflect the back blast of the initial detonator charge and thereby propel the artillery shells outward. Zarif had created identical devices many times in the past, and he'd destroyed enemy armor with them at a range of up to 50 feet. It took him nearly 3 hours to ready the IED high on the open wall, and then he covered the entire device with plastic bags, threading them through the rebar, wrapping them from the blast plate in back to the nose cones in front, protecting everything and hiding the bomb from the other Maldonado men. He and his helpers then cleared back the scaffolding and the ladder, and finally they called for the men to bring in the cement blower. 3 hours after this, the concrete was poured all around the device, and the next morning, when the quick-drying concrete had formed, workers began placing a thin sheet of stone veneer over the front of the wall. By noon the next day, the entire facade was complete. From Vidal Alcocer, the six-lane street down which the president would travel, it looked like a massive concrete parking lot wall with a decorative facade. But in truth, it hid the explosive force of 3 howitzer rounds, and on command, the rounds would launch out into the road in front of it and detonate. But Zarif wasn't finished. In the afternoon, Zarif had Emilio take him to a grocery store, and here he grabbed a basket and walked directly to the spice section. He picked up several containers of cumin and turmeric. Emilio asked, "Are you making dinner?" "You'll see." They returned to the construction site. It was empty again, but now the tarp in front of the wall had been cleared away, and they walked around the wall and under the tarp on the Jose J. Herrera side. Zarif went to his wall, pulled out his containers of spices, opened them, and got down on his hands and knees. Slowly and meticulously he began pouring them along where the floor met the new wall. He used a lot right below the device, and then he crawled in each direction, sprinkling less and less until he had covered the entire floor. He stood up, dusted off his hands, and walked over to a drain in the concrete floor of the parking garage. He knelt down and peered through the metal grating, then looked up to Emilio. "One more thing. I need you to find me a dead animal." "What?" "Really dead." An hour later, a Maldonado runner arrived on the back of a motorcycle. In his hand, he carried a white garbage bag. He handed it to Zarif, who opened the bag and recoiled from the stench. A putrefying cat lay inside. Zarif walked over to the open drain, removed the grating, and dumped the dead cat out of the bag. It fell in just 2 feet before landing where the drain pipe turned. He looked to Emilio. "This will also affect the dogs' noses." Emilio nodded. "What dogs?" "The Americans will search this area before the president drives by. I've seen it on YouTube. They will bring dogs that can smell explosives. But here the dogs will smell spices and dead cats." He pointed up high on the wall. "Even if they check the wall, they won't check up so high. No one will look for a bomb that points down." Zarif grinned at his own cleverness. Chapter 50 Adam spent his first day at the Chongju refinery installing his new computer terminal. Even though the machine was a new but run-of-the-mill PC, it had been shipped from France and had been loaded with a few off-the-shelf mining software programs he would use to operate the massive cone crusher. None of the software was terribly complicated, but the tools were very specific in nature, and even though Adam had learned the job in a couple weeks, no one in North Korea had the training or the experience to run the machine. This meant Adam was the only person authorized to use the terminal, and this was extremely good news for Adam, because the cone crusher operating program wasn't the most distinctive thing about this PC. Adam had been briefed and trained by the CIA's science and technology staff on how to use the terminal to send clandestine messages back to the Akrid Herald Operations Center at the Liberty Crossing Intelligence Campus. Even though the device wasn't attached to the Internet, there was a text feature that was connected not to the computer's hard drive and motherboard, but to another device that had been built into all the hardware. It was essentially a satellite phone without a speaker, just the components of the device that could make a connection via satellite and send a text message. The miniaturized pieces of the device were so well hidden within the rest of the computer hardware inside the tower that even if the North Koreans disassembled the machine, they would need a computer hardware expert to come to the conclusion that tiny pieces that didn't belong were attached to different parts of the motherboard and power supply. Even then, it would be nigh on impossible to discern just what the equipment was, only that it wasn't needed. But that wasn't covert enough for science and technology. The tiny components they did use were all Chinese in manufacture, made by the company Huawei, which surely everyone in North Korean intelligence knew had ties to Chinese intelligence. Taking this extra step ensured that even if the computer was revealed as an intelligence collection device, China would be the country blamed for spying on the Chongzhou operation. That wouldn't do Adam one damn bit of good. North Korean counter-intel would shoot him for being a Chinese spy just as quickly as they would shoot him for being an American spy. But at least America would be in the clear. On his first day getting his machine up and running, Adam realized he couldn't have asked for a better desk. He had the lone workstation at a cubicle alongside a two-story tall cone-crushing machine. As far as secure locations went to broadcast his messages back to Odney, he felt like he was in a comfortable place. Several men worked on the machine in his proximity, most of them on a catwalk above him, but Adam was the only man with any business in the back of the machine where his workstation stood. Further, the other workers were mechanical engineers and simple ore loaders, and Adam doubted they would notice anything amiss even if they did see him opening the texting program to contact Odney. This cone crusher had been here in North Korea for a year and a half, long before construction started on the refinery. The state-owned Chinese company Chinalco put the machine at the Chongzhou mine itself, a kilometer to the east, because the Chinese had planned on crushing the ore down to processing size so it could be transported in sacks on trucks, as opposed to larger rocks which were harder to ferry. But the North Koreans had no problem trucking the ore the kilometer to the processing facility, so they brought the massive machine here, where the electricity ran more regularly than at the mine. Right after a 15-minute break for tea and plant-wide government-mandated singing, stretching, and knee bends, Adam returned to his desk with plans to send his first message home. He checked his area to make sure there was no one around who could see what he was doing. This involved him simply looking back over his shoulder and then scanning overhead through the grating of the catwalk. When he was comfortable that he was clear, he restarted his PC, then went into the BIOS screen of the computer. Here he changed a series of settings, and then pressed Enter. He had two choices now. He could type a 1, which would take him to the texting program, or he could type a 2, which would send him to a satellite map of North Korea that had been hidden on the drive. In the case of an emergency exfiltration, Adam's minders had had the foresight to realize, he would need a good idea of the area and the ability to type in specific coordinates, so the function had been secreted on the drive. Adam wasn't on the run now, and he hoped like hell he never would be, so he typed 1 and hit Enter again. The screen went blank, except for a small blinking cursor in the lower right. Adam had to admit, S&T had set this up so no one was going to accidentally find the clandestine software. He took another glance around, then quickly typed out a message, all in Mandarin, so if it was somehow intercepted, the U.S. would not be blamed for the operation. Secret. 2. Flash for tidal wave. From Avalanche. Subject, Arrival Establishment. Source, Avalanche. 1. All nominal. Full report soonest. 2. Flash. Director Huang Min-ho met with Avalanche and other China techs 2 days prior in Pyongyang. He claims 1 further shipment of large equipment to arrive before facility online. No indication of type of equipment. With no further corroboration, Avalanche cannot independently confirm. 3. Huang claims he will be present at processing facility in coming weeks. Avalanche. The final reference to his codename was the tip that he was not writing under duress. Had he signed off with anything else, or nothing at all, the control officers of Acrid Herald would have known the words on their screen could not be taken at face value. Adam hit the enter key twice. This directed the satellite phone to send the digital message. Science and technology had warned him about this part. Back in McLean, they let him know the sending could take a couple minutes, and some messages might have to be resent. As good as the technology was, and the eggheads from Langley promised it was the best, there were always atmospheric conditions that could come into play, as well as issues with other equipment at the Chongju facility. They'd also given him one more interesting tidbit of information. Most sat phones blast their signals to one of many commercial satellites, but this phone beamed to an NSA satellite in geostationary orbit over North Korea, parts of China and Japan. He was assured the signal would broadcast eventually, but was reminded to wait for a confirmation from the computer in the form of a long row of dashes that ran from left to right. After a minute and a half, he received this confirmation. Adam was pleasantly surprised. The boys and girls at S&T, who didn't have to be out in the field with the devices, didn't just put a big flashing message sent graphic on the monitor. Chapter 51. As Director of National Intelligence, Mary Pat Foley was the Chief Intelligence Officer of the United States of America, and with this role quite naturally came a tremendous amount of responsibility and a large number of draws on her time. So the fact that she made a third trip down the George Washington Memorial Parkway to the offices of Hendley Associates indicated the importance of the intelligence product being generated by the Sub Rosa private outfit run by former South Carolina Senator Jerry Hendley. Today's meeting was not with the entire campus operational staff. Instead, only Mary Pat, Jerry Hendley, and Jack Ryan sat in the conference room. Sam was still in New York, monitoring Sharp's partners. And there would be no after-action report today, as they had done to explain their activities in Vietnam, so Clark, Chavez, and Caruso remained at their desks. Ryan imparted the knowledge they had gleaned on the operation without going into details of shootouts and breaking and entering. He was careful to avoid any more detail about the events of Las Vegas than was necessary. Ryan explained how a Sharps agent copied the proprietary software, certainly to give to the North Koreans. Mary Pat listened carefully. When Jack's presentation was finished, she seemed to consider how much she would tell the men around her, but apparently she decided on partial disclosure. "Your information is helpful. We have our own intelligence source that picked up something that fits in with what you were telling me." Jack knew better than to ask, "What source?" Mary Pat said, "The Chongju refinery is expecting a shipment of material in the next few days." The source did not know what was coming in, only that the shipment would be very large. Jack said, "Froth flotation cells certainly fit that description. The ones at Valley Floor are each probably the size of an SUV. They've got a dozen or more, so if Chongju was expecting a shipment of those, you can bet it would be big." Mary Pat said, "If Chongju was expecting a shipment of flotation cells in the next week, they'd be on the water right now." Ryan and the other Hendley men assumed there wasn't much the United States could do about it if they were on the water. There was no law stopping the shipment of mining equipment. Mary Pat returned to Liberty Crossing and immediately put in a call to CIA. Within minutes, she had a team of men and women, all financial forensic specialists, trying to find any trace of either a sale or a shipment of froth flotation cells. This was trickier than it might seem. While froth flotation cells were not exactly a common commodity bought and sold around the world, different versions of the units were used in many different kinds of industries. Additionally, it wasn't a sanctioned material, so the commerce of the items, as for most industrial products, was not necessarily recorded. But the team was good, and they found 4 recent movements of the exact material in the first 3 hours of research. A Canadian company had just sold 9 cells of the size and capability of that supported by the software. A Brazilian mine had gone out of business in the past year, and all of its cells had been purchased some months earlier. An Australian firm had custom-built 12 cells just in the past month. And a Malaysian processing facility had upgraded to new tanks and sold its old cells off. The economic forensic team began with the Canadian transaction. Quickly, it was confirmed that the goods were still in Vancouver and were to be shipped to Brazil, to another rare earth refinery. The company, its owners, and their known affiliations were double and triple checked as the CIA looked for any evidence of a straw man purchase for the North Koreans. But ultimately, they decided the transaction was legitimate. Next, they looked at the defunct Brazilian processing plant. A deep scrub of the company and the sale showed them the cells were sold from one company entity to another, certainly to avoid losing the capital in bankruptcy proceedings. The analysts asked a CIA officer in Sao Paulo to fly up to Belo Horizonte immediately to go eyeball the goods at the warehouse where the records said they were now being stored, but this appeared to be a dead end as well. Ditto the Australian sale. Its custom-built froth flotation cells were on their way to the Linus Advanced Materials Plant rare earth facility near Kuantan, Malaysia. This was one of the larger and more modern facilities in the world, and they processed much of Australia's rare earths. Even though the facility was just a few years old, it was not terribly surprising that they would upgrade their cells, because new developments in the field had heralded new technology, and LAMP was cutting edge. This left one more transaction. Where did the old cells from LAMP go? The analytical team saw a red flag very quickly. The machinery had been sold 4 months earlier to a company that existed only on paper. That company went up in smoke, but before it went out of business, it transferred its capital to a holding group registered in Singapore. This turned out to be a dead end, at least in the short term, but the analysts knew their higher-ups were hell-bent on getting quick answers. They turned their attention to the location of the physical material. Linus was an Australian company, so a conversation between CIA Director Jay Canfield and his counterpart, the Director of Australian Intelligence, led to a conference call between CIA analysts and Australian businessmen, which led to Malaysian shipping clerks in Kota Baru, a port on Malaysia's eastern shore. They confirmed a dozen large crates had been shipped in several trucks from Kuantan, warehoused in Kota Baru, and then placed in 4 45-foot high cube shipping containers and placed on board a ship just 14 days earlier. That ship sailed to Manila, where the cargo was offloaded and driven away by private vehicles. This looked like yet another dead end, but the analysts did not give up. They knew a CIA source. None of them were read in on Akrid Herald, had revealed the equipment was due to arrive in the next few days, so they began working the equation from the other direction, looking at shipping heading to North Korea. An Indonesian-flagged cargo ship, the San Fernando Chieftain, had begun a voyage in Marseille that would terminate in North Korea. On its way, it made several ports of call, and one of those ports was Manila, just 6 days earlier. The entire team began working on digging into the cargo on board and within a short time they learned 4 45-foot high cube shipping containers from Malaysia, categorized only as machinery, had been placed on the manifest in the port of Manila. And the San Fernando chieftain was now just 30 hours from arriving in the territorial waters of North Korea. The economic forensics team delivered their findings up the chain, and they moved on to something else the next day, wholly unaware of the importance of the matter, or the full scope of their contribution. When Mary Pat Foley received the news, she realized she had all the information she needed, but that in itself solved nothing. Finding evidence that a ship heading to North Korea contained particular items, if those items were not bound by sanction restrictions, did nothing to stop the items from reaching North Korea. Still, Mary Pat decided, the president needed to know that evidence led to the fact that North Korea needed but one more piece of the puzzle to begin production on their cash cow, and that puzzle piece seemed to be just one day away. She called Arnie Van Dam herself and asked for an immediate slot to see the president. Arnie said he would be in and out of meetings all day preparing for his official visit to Mexico, but he worked her in immediately without protest. Mary Pat Foley rolled onto the White House grounds 50 minutes later, and she was led into the Oval as she had been hundreds of times. She found the president on the sofa, laughing at something the distinguished-looking man sitting in front of him had just said. Ryan stood and introduced Foley to Horatio Stiles, the U.S. ambassador to Mexico. He explained that Stiles was up in Washington just for 2 days, and then he'd be returning with the president on Air Force One for his official visit. After the introductions, the ambassador left the Oval Office on his way back to the Department of State. As soon as he was gone, Ryan said, "Hell of a guy. He served all over the world as a Marine officer, but he fell in love with Latin America. He retired a colonel, then got his Ph.D. in Latin American Studies from Columbia. He's probably the most capable non-career State Department employee serving as an ambassador. If he spreads his wings a little, he's got the makings of a hell of a Secretary of State." "Yes, sir," Mary Pat said, and the president sat back down. "Okay, you're not here to listen to me brag about my brilliant ambassadorship nominations. What's up?" She told him about the shipload of equipment heading to Chongju, and the fact it was likely the last major component necessary before the refinery became operational. Ryan listened carefully. His first question did not surprise her in the least. "This comes from our new source at the mine?" "Partially, yes." Mary Pat didn't mention that the president's own son had provided crucial bits of intel. Jack looked long and hard at his director of national intelligence, trying to read her thoughts. He noted the ambiguity in her answer, and he was used to it. His people shielded him from things. He didn't much like it, but he understood it. His mind switched from Mary Pat to the issue at hand. The UN Sanctions Committee refused to vote on increasing the economic sanctions against North Korea that Ryan knew were crucial to choking off the Hermit Kingdom's access to the hard currency it was using to obtain nuclear missile technology. Ryan had been thinking about what steps he was prepared to take unilaterally. He'd not yet come to a conclusion, but he'd now run out of time to mull it over. He had to act. "Mary Pat, from what we've learned in the past month, the evidence is clear, and it all points to the fact this Chongju facility is serving as a funding vehicle for North Korea's nuclear weapons program. I am going to go to the National Security Council and authorize a presidential directive stating the Chongju mineral mine and processing facility in North Korea represents a clear and present danger to the security of the United States, and I will direct that our military, intelligence, and diplomatic efforts be engaged in keeping that facility from going into full production." He added, "I'm not going to attack it. That would just send North Korean artillery and missiles raining down on Seoul, but I am damn well going to do everything short of that." Mary Pat had rarely seen her president more resolute. "Yes, sir. Please be aware, though, that if you want the Navy to interdict that ship, they will have to do it within 24 hours, or it will be in North Korean waters." Ryan nodded. "I understand. I'm going to call Burgess right now and tell him about the directive. By the time he gets forces in position to stop that boat, the paper will be signed." Ryan rubbed his nose under his eyeglasses. "We'll take heat for it, but it needs to happen." Mary Pat left the Oval minutes later. She had work to do, perhaps less than the National Security Council, because they had just hours to draw up a presidential directive for POTUS to sign. But once this was done, Mary Pat knew the gloves were off. A presidential directive carried the full force and effect of law, and with it in place, she and her counterparts in the Defense Department and the State Department would be directed to do whatever they could to see that the Chungju mine earned no more money for the North Korean nuclear weapons program. And even though the battle would be fought in a coordinated fashion by the combined power of the entire United States government, the Director of National Intelligence was keenly aware that at the very tip of the spear in this endeavor was a young man in North Korea who was as alone as anyone could possibly be. Chapter 52. Dale Herbers of the U.S. Secret Service was a week into his advance in Mexico City before he drove the presidential motorcade route from the airport to the Palacio Nacional. This was by design. He could have run the route earlier in his workup, but he felt his other responsibilities, securing the locations of the various static events of the president's trip to the city, were better taken care of first, and the motorcade route saved for closer to the actual day of. Things changed on the streets more than they changed in museums, restaurants, government buildings, and other attractions, and Herbers, like most advanced team shift leaders, wanted a game-time feel to the route the president would travel. The 47-year-old lead special agent and his senior staff of a dozen special agents, as well as several counterparts from various Mexican law enforcement agencies who were working the motorcade, all left Benito Juarez Airport just after noon, the exact time of the president's scheduled arrival in 2 days. They drove together in a convoy of vehicles on a westerly route toward the Plaza de la Constitución, the massive central square where the palace stood, and the president's motorcade from the airport would terminate. One of the most important parts of the advance team's work was identifying the choke points and crowd-gathering locations, the places where the motorcade would need to slow down to negotiate turns. Today his role was to assign American and Mexican law enforcement to these key portions of the motorcade, and to identify any other potential threats so as to deal with them now, before the president arrived. In all the official events swordsmen would attend here in Mexico, even those open to the public, every spectator and participant would be subjected to screening. This meant they would either pass through metal detectors or be wanded. And all bags would, of course, be searched. But it was impossible to secure the route. Every window, rooftop, alleyway, every pocket of every civilian on every sidewalk, and every car on every side street. Motorcades were a mess. But the Secret Service was accustomed to dealing with them. The president would be ushered along the way in the bubble, a Secret Service term meaning a protective cocoon of close protection agents, a large counter-assault team that rode just behind him, and an array of static Secret Service men on rooftops and barricade positions along the route. There were more than 200 agents here in Mexico City for the visit, and virtually every last one of them had a role in the motorcade from the airport. And that was just the first line of defense. Mexican federal police would have another 600 officers involved in roadblocks, motorcycle escorts, traffic control, and crowd overwatch. And Herbers had one more thing going in his favor. The Beast. The presidential limousine was a highly modified and customized Cadillac DTS and had acquired the name The Beast because of its size and weight. but bulletproof glass and thick armor plating were just two of the vehicle's features. Run-flat tires, night vision equipment, an internal oxygen supply, and secure communications also made up the vehicle's security measures, and another identical vehicle always ran in the motorcade, so the president would have a backup if his primary broke down. Herbers had been informed that Swordsman had been asked to stay in the Beast for the duration of the drive by his lead protection agent, Andrea Price O'Day. This wasn't likely to be an issue. Some presidents liked to get out and glad-hand the crowd, but that wasn't really Ryan's style. While Herbers thought him to be a kind and approachable man, Ryan didn't possess the politician gene of so many of the other people he'd worked around in his 23 years on the service. Ryan didn't go out of his way to meet people unless it was necessary to win an election. The convoy of advance team men and women stopped many times along the route, and all of them would then climb out of their vehicles. Herbers would see a group of open windows that bothered him, or a troublesome building with balconies or other potential aggressor overwatch positions, or even just narrow side streets that ran close to his route that he wanted to look over to see if he felt it necessary to block them off. This was an experienced group, and despite all the stops, they accomplished the first half of the route in good time. But then they traveled through the high-crime neighborhood of Tepito, and this part of the city required extra care. When Agent Dale Herbers started his workup of the Mexico official visit, he and his staff quickly identified the short stretch of Eje Uno as a location that needed special attention. Every motorcade had to either go down this long, straight, six-lane thoroughfare or else navigate the narrow two-lane streets of the Tepito and Centro districts. As much as the Secret Service tried to avoid taking the president on a predictable route, it had been decided that was preferable to taking him through a narrow warren of alleys surrounded by close-in buildings, subjecting the motorcade to twice as many turns and forcing it to travel much more slowly through such a rough district. Now, this stretch of Eje Uno, called Vidal Alcocer, was undoubtedly the best route to take. Which meant every motorcade from the airport used it. And this was a problem. So now Herbers was here, looking over every block with a critical eye. He walked this vulnerable part of the motorcade route, shadowed by four other Secret Service agents and four detectives from Mexico's Federal District Police. They took notes on paper and on tablet computers, as Herbers directed the different organizations in how to prepare for the upcoming motorcade. On the corner of Vidal Alcocer and José J. Herrera, Herbers noticed a construction site with a long 12-foot-high wall running north and south along the sidewalk, and next to it a street market running west on Herrera. A Mexican detective explained how they had planned to barricade the market off from the motorcade route, and Herbers immediately crossed the street and ducked under the orange tarp at the southern edge of the site. The others followed him in. He and his team spent a few minutes inside, walking around. He was looking for stashed weapons, a sniper's hide, anything out of the ordinary. As soon as he headed over to the clean and newly poured concrete eastern wall of the site, he smelled the rotten stench of something dead. The other men smelled it, too, and it took less than 30 seconds for a Mexican federal district officer to shine his flashlight in the sealed drain on the floor of the garage. "Gato," he said. "Cat." Herbers looked himself. Poor kitty must have gone down there before they covered the drain and got caught. He didn't give it another thought. Herbers looked at the wall next. One of his men had a flashlight of his own, and he walked the length of the wall, tapping it both at waist height and a little higher than his head, just to confirm there was no false compartment built into it. A bomb-sniffing dog was led along the wall. She sniffed in the edges and immediately pulled her head back and sneezed. She kept walking, kept trying to sniff the area, and sneezed again. Herbers glanced up to the dog handler for an explanation. The handler just said, "Construction dust. Masonry and loose grout." He kept going. Within seconds, they were moving into the next concrete staircase. Herbers kept scanning the area for a few minutes. He saw a radio on a bucket, and he lifted the device and kicked over the bucket to make sure it wasn't wired to anything. He turned the radio on and heard a scratchy, accordion-heavy tune. He flipped it off and replaced it on the bucket. Herbers addressed both the Secret Service agents with him and the Federal District Police detectives. "I'll need this place sealed off with tape, and officers outside on the corner during the transit." One of the Mexican detectives said, "I will have two cars behind the barricade outside on Jose J. Herrera. Four men watching the people at the market and the crowd that will form at the barricade so they can see the limo. I'll task two more men just to make sure no one tries to slip under the tarp to get into the construction site." "That's fine," Herbers said. Then he addressed his number two. "Rick, I want a pair of our guys here as well." "You got it. Let's put a long gun at the top of the stairs. It will give us a good view of the entire length of the street." Rick made a note. They climbed out of the construction site and moved on to the next choke point, a turn to the west that would take them deep into the Centro Histórico toward the Palacio Nacional. Herbers and his team had dozens of problem areas to check before the president arrived in less than 48 hours. Chapter 53. After waiting for 2 days in Las Vegas for instructions from the Home Office, Veronica Martell finally received orders from Edward Riley to fly to New York. She didn't even check into a hotel. Instead, she drove right to the Sharps Global Intelligence Partners building, and there she was led into Sharps's fifth-floor office. Riley was there, but he said surprisingly little. Sharps did most of the talking as he grilled her about her actions over her 2 weeks at Valley Floor. Martell had made the decision early on not to mention her contact with Jack Ryan Jr. Had she done so from the start, she would be in the clear. But now she saw no way she could explain that he had been around her at the time she was operational at Valley Floor and that she had simply neglected to mention it. If she revealed his actions, actions she thought at the time were born from his interest in her, then she would look either incompetent or complicit. And Veronica did not think for a moment Riley would believe she was incompetent. She didn't see herself as such either, but she wholly admitted she had been greedy. Her desire to turn a mundane corporate intelligence operation into a one-woman attempt to recruit an important contact, and in so doing leave her corporate work behind, had been foolish, and she had been grossly overconfident. Now all she could do was mitigate the damage, bury any evidence of her attempt to recruit Ryan and leave Sharps behind, and portray herself as the unjust victim of a Sharps op that had been compromised somewhere else. This worked surprisingly well. Sharps had allowed that an unknown actor had showed up during the New World Medals operation, first in Vietnam, then during a phase that occurred here in New York, and finally in Las Vegas. Sharps said that while Veronica had been involved in Vietnam and Vegas, she had no knowledge of the operation in New York. So he was of the opinion she was not to blame for whatever leak had allowed the theft of the mobile phone and the compromise of the operation. Martell gave a full-throated defense of her actions. She was careful not to cast any aspersions on Riley, because he was, A, her supervisor, and someone she would have to continue working with, and, B, right here in the room. She wondered later if she should have gone ahead and beat up on the Englishman anyway, because Riley had maintained his uncomfortable silence throughout the entire meeting, and Veronica took this as either some sort of culpability or even weakness. When it was over, Duke told Veronica that she would be required to stay in town, perhaps for just a few days, but perhaps for longer. That afternoon she found a vacation rental on the Lower East Side. She wasn't operational, so she rented the property in her own name, but in a nod to her personal security, she performed the transaction on the Internet and picked the key card up from a Dropbox so she wouldn't have to deal with anyone face to face. The place wasn't home, and her unit was a small third-floor walk-up, but on the inside, anyway, it felt a little like Paris. It was better than a shoebox New York City hotel, and it was much better than a gaudy Vegas faux Wonderland casino hotel. Sam Driscoll had spent a week and a half watching, filming, and reviewing every person who entered the offices of Sharp's Global Intelligence Partners. He was across the street at an angle, north of Duke Sharp's building on Columbus, and sometimes he couldn't get great pictures of people entering. But virtually every person who exited the building got their picture taken, and these went into the facial recognition program. His boring work paid off on day 10, when the woman going by the name Elise Legrand entered the building. Ryan had made special mention of her, and he told Sam that anything he could do to track the woman after she left would be appreciated. Sam had barely left his rented studio flat in a week and a half, so he was more than happy to take the opportunity to go off in hot pursuit. When she left the building an hour later, Sam was seated on a park bench on the sidewalk next to the American Museum of Natural History, with a 12-speed bike and a backpack next to him. The woman climbed into a cab, and he took off after her, then easily tailed her a few blocks south to a coffee shop, where he saw her working on a tablet computer. After an hour, over a tea and her iPad, she climbed into another taxi. This time Sam had a difficult time tracking her, because she went all the way through Midtown, finally ending up on the Lower East Side. If he had been in a car or even on a motorcycle, he would have lost her. But with his bike, he was able to skirt traffic and traffic laws, so he managed to keep her cab in sight until she climbed out on Clinton Street, put a code into a key box hanging from a railing in front of an apartment building, removed an electronic key card, and then carried her luggage up to the door. Sam waited to see a light turn on the third floor, and then he pedaled his bike all the way back up to 77th and Columbus. The next morning, Veronica rose early, dressed, and headed out on foot to a cafe for breakfast, and then she walked to a local market. She told herself she'd be here for a while, so she filled a grocery cart with food and drinks, and even flowers, and took it all back to her place. It was a struggle to get everything up the three flights of stairs, but she managed, and she unlocked her door with her key card and struggled some more getting everything in and on the counter. After she had done this, she turned around and headed into her living room, and then she stopped cold. She felt the expression of panic on her face, so she fought against it and did her best to appear nonchalant. She asked, "How did you find me?" Jack Ryan Jr. sat on the sofa, his legs crossed. He wore a dark gray pinstriped suit and a burgundy tie, and he appeared utterly calm. Sometimes the old-fashioned ways work best. "You've been watching Sharp's office." "A colleague has." "What do you want?"
"Sit down, Veronica." Hearing her own name brought the panic back, but she did as instructed, and she tried again to feign an air of detachment.
"How did you get into the apartment?" When Ryan did not immediately speak, she said, "Let me guess. You used the same site code hack your people used to get into my hotel room in Las Vegas."
Ryan replied, "Sometimes the new ways work best."
"Who do you work for?"
Ryan did not reply.
"Like father, like son?
You are CIA."
He shook his head.
"I know people, that's all. No law against that. Sometimes they need help. You are the one who has to explain herself."
"Corporate intelligence is as old as corporations themselves. I've done nothing to be ashamed of."
Ryan chuckled, and it angered her.
"What is it you think you have on me?"
"Veronica M.A. Martel, age 38. Born Rambouillet, France. You served in the DGSE for 7 years, received high marks, very high. Then you had an affair with a deputy of the French National Assembly. Ryan wasn't reading this. He had it memorized. Not a big deal in France, I don't guess. Unless his wife happens to be the vice secretary of the Socialist Party. Veronica crossed her arms, a reflexive action to guard herself from danger. A bad decision on your part, but it shouldn't have affected your career as a spy. Still, you got banished from the service, scooped up by Duke Sharps, and put back to work. Very good, Jack. You have sources. That doesn't give you the right to break into my flat. Now Ryan uncrossed his legs and looked forward. My friends were there in Ho Chi Minh City, the evening Colin Hazelton was murdered. Martell made no reaction. She didn't know the name, but she could guess who Hazelton was. Still, she gave nothing away. They got a good picture of you that night. And they have the ability to put faces with names. But nothing came up on you. My guess is either DGSE or Sharps had all files with your image erased. Not all, obviously. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. You used your real name to rent this place. My friends searched for Veronica Martell, and they found some references to you. No image, but they didn't need the image once they had the name. What do you want? I didn't kill this man in Ho Chi Minh City. I don't even know what you're talking about. North Korean assassins were in Vietnam, in the Czech Republic, in Vegas, and right here in New York. People are dying to keep your mission up and running. It's not my mission. No, it's Edward Riley's mission. But you are his foot soldier, and now you are going to help my friends tie him directly to North Korea. She laughed now. Ridiculous. He isn't working with North Korea. DPRK goons seem to turn up conveniently wherever he needs them. That's good enough for me. If that was true, they would be here now, wouldn't they? Believe me, there were concerns they would be. But I have friends all over your block, ready for them, and they swept your place for bugs. The North Koreans seem to have forgotten about you for the time being. My guess is you were sidelined, out of the operation, after what happened in Las Vegas. I hope that is true. If I am done, then I will return to Brussels, and this will all be behind me. You don't understand the stakes, Veronica. You are in danger as long as you are working with Sharps. If the North Koreans think for a second you failed them, they will do to you what they did to Colin Hazelton. Ryan crossed over to her side of the sitting area and knelt in front of her. He moved so close she thought he was going to kiss her. Help us, and we will protect you. I need no protection. I do need you to leave. Ryan didn't move back. You tricked me once in Las Vegas. You won't trick me again. This is no trick. Are you going to arrest me? No. That is not the job of the CIA. She smiled now. She had been off kilter for a while, but she felt like she had regained her ground. And now the man in front of her, so smug and sure of himself, did not know what to say. Get out. Please, Veronica. Out! Jack Ryan sighed. Then he pulled out a pen and wrote his phone number on a magazine. My friends will keep someone in town. If you change your mind, or if you are in any trouble and need us, call me, and someone will be here in minutes. Veronica stood and pointed to the door. Get out! Ryan left the apartment, certain that the woman behind him had no idea how far the North Koreans were willing to go to see this to the end. Chapter 54. Presidential directive or no, there was neither legal nor justifiable reason as far as international law was concerned, for the boarding and inspection of the San Fernando Chieftain, an Indonesian-flagged container ship making 15 knots in a roiling yellow sea. True, it was on its way to the North Korean port of Nampo, southwest of Pyongyang, but the ship's stated destination was North Korea, so it had already been inspected by international proliferation experts just before setting sail at Manila Terminal 6 days earlier. The cargo was confirmed to match the manifests. It was food aid and car parts and machinery for the nation's large coal mining industry. The ship also broadcast its automatic identification system for its entire voyage, and there were absolutely no irregularities with its movements. In short, the San Fernando Chieftain played by the rules, so the captain was furious now, standing in his wheelhouse, his binoculars to his eyes and fixed on a point 3 miles off his bow. Though it was late morning, a heavy squall darkened the skies and obscured his view slightly, but there was no mistaking the image in his optics. It was the massive American warship USS Freedom, and it had positioned itself in the path of the San Fernando Chieftain, blocking the way ahead. The radio call left the captain even more confused and angry. The Americans demanded to board. The captain asked them on what grounds they thought they had the right to do so, and the Americans cited UN Resolution 1874. The Indonesian captain responded with outrage. The paperwork was on file, and his transit had been documented. But the Americans were not listening to his reason. They informed him an armed boarding party was on the way, and for the safety of the captain, his crew, and his cargo, he needed to come full stop and comply with all demands. The captain immediately called his home office. At this point, there was nothing he could do but complain, because even though he was in the right, he wasn't about to fight the United States Navy. At 10:56, Chief Daryl Ricks of Echo Platoon